Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Mr. Pop.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
47 years ago,
when in the course of human events,
and so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of 10 American Presidents. I'm Royfield Brown, the producer of the series. Now, I haven't done an awful lot of podcasts this year, but one thing I have done is I've written a chapter on President Martin Van Buren for Ian Dale's book, The Presidents, which is actually out now. What you're going to hear in this episode is an excerpt of my chapter, a rather large excerpt, which is narrated by Ian Dale. And also what you're going to hear at the start is my interview with Ian on his show, on his podcast, talking about Martin Van Buren and his legacy. So this is somewhat of a Christmas festive treat for you, considering you've had very meager pickings from me in 2021. So first is my interview with Ian Dale. It's just an excerpt. And then you have another excerpt of a reading from the book, The President by Ian Dale. I suggest you go out to all good bookshops and go and purchase a copy now.
Hello and welcome to the Presidents and Prime Ministers podcast with me, Ian Dale. This podcast series accompanies my two books, The Presidents and the Prime Ministers. And each week you'll hear about a different American president or British prime minister. Well, today we're going to talk to the presenter of the Mid-Atlantic podcast, Royfield Brown, about the life and presidency of Martin Van Buren, who served as president from 1837 to 1841. Royfield, good to have you on the podcast. What made you choose Martin Van Buren as the president you wanted to write about? Because not an obvious choice in some ways.
He's not an obvious choice, but I love Van Buren because he not only frames the modern American political system, but also he kind of points at an alternative history of America, because he's the only American president who didn't speak English as the first language. So he spoke Dutch, who were the first inhabitants actually of New Amsterdam, New York, you know, and the kind of the Dutch history in America is kind of, it's writ large, but we kind of forget about it. So the two Roosevelt is a Dutch surname, and then the Vanderbilts. And we know these as American names, American families, but they were Dutch, not English. So an alternative history, and maybe that you would be in the United States of America, but we'd be saying it in Dutch, not English.
I always wanted to learn Dutch, but I can't think what the United States of America would be in Dutch just as well, probably. So, who was Martin Van Buren? Where did he come from? Where was he born? What was his education like?
Well, another little thing about Martin Van Buren is the expression OK. Now, there's a certain amount of dispute about it, but OK, we think, comes from Old Kinderhook, which is the presidential campaign which he loses in 1840. So it's from a little town called Kinderhook. So if you were OK, you were for Old Kinderhook, which is Van Buren.
Oh, right.
So Kinderhook is this town in New York State, not too far away from New York City. And quite simply, he had a relatively... You read all the books and you read the essays and he has this modest upbringing. But in the great scheme of things, it was a little bit more than just modest. His father was a tavern owner who'd fought in the American Revolutionary War. And he could send his son off to school, then also then off to, well, he becomes a lawyer, but he's not, he went to lawyer school or anything like that back then. You worked with under another lawyer, you literally swept their floors, and then that way, then in the evenings, you read their books, and then you became a lawyer. So he had, by American standards back then, a slightly upper average kind of upbringing, but he wasn't, you know, a Washington or a Jefferson. He was not landed gentry at all. He's a relatively normal, and that's kind of one of the great things about him, is that he could rise up from being literally nobody, a bit like Jackson beforehand, and become, you know, the head of the United States.
That's quite interesting, because there was quite a few presidents around that time who weren't the founding fathers, who weren't the signatories on the Declaration of Independence. It was sort of a new generation was sweeping in.
Well, he's also the first American president who wasn't a British citizen as well. So he's definitely of this new phase of American leaders who can't remember the Revolutionary War. You know, he doesn't know of another world other than an independent United States.
So after school, he started practice as a lawyer. Was he very successful?
He was. And he cuts a bit of a dash. And what kind of helps to inform his politics is the fact that he becomes a champion of the common man. So that then goes to inform his politics going forward. He's not a grandee. As I said, he's not part of the planter class. You know, he's not from Virginia, where, you know, Jefferson and Washington are from. He's from New York State. And he's from this bit of America which sees himself as very meritocratic. But he kind of sees that there are landed interests and moneyed interests, and he's very much for the common man. So he always fights against those interests and for the regular Joe.
Before we start talking about his political career, I think it's important at this stage for people who don't know about all the sort of party machinations in the 1820s and 1830s to just explain how the American parties grew up, really, because there weren't the Democrats and the Republicans back in the late 18th century, early part of the 19th century. Just sort of give us a crash course in how the American parties really formed in this period.
Well, one of the things which the founding fathers kind of have in mind is they don't want their politics to be riven by partisan sectionalism.
Yeah.
They don't. So Washington kind of, in his last inaugural address, basically rails against the partisan divide. So in the presidency of Washington, at least in the first term, there are no political parties. It's all good Americans together. By the time of the presidency of Adams, you have the Federalists, who believe in a bigger government, and a national bank, of which Hamilton, the musical, he's very much the archetype of the Federalist Party. And then you have the Democratic...
Which I disgracefully still haven't seen, but...
It's rather good.
So I'm told.
Saw it in San Francisco. And then you have the Democratic Republicans, who their kind of figurehead is Jefferson, who believe that the unit of governance should be as small as possible, and this is all about you, the individual, exercising your own free right to do kind of whatever. That's the easiest way to divide the two. By the time you get to the 1810s, the Federalists are basically a busted flush. So America goes into this weird period from the 1810s to the late 1820s, where there's only really one political party. But that's going to really massively inform the American political system as we have it today, because the Democratic Republicans are driven by factions. It's really a period where American politics is really driven by personality. The difference between, let's say, Clay or Adams or Jackson is actually really quite minuscule, but it's all about where you're actually from in the United States. You're a northerner, you're a southerner, are you from one of the middle states, or your personality. And that really kind of gets to inform that kind of period of American politics.
Now, Van Buren believed in small national government, as you said, and that was another split in American politics, wasn't it? Almost throughout the 19th century, what still is to a certain extent, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That between the power of the federal government and the power of the states. So he allied himself with the Democratic Republicans, and that was what really got him into national politics, wasn't it?
He is really, before he goes into national politics, he is incredibly powerful in state politics in New York. And he kind of rails against other Democratic Republicans who sees as not being as pure to that small government ideal. And he forms a faction called the Bushtails. And really what he learns there is party discipline. Remember, his father actually owned a tavern, and that's really important in understanding his story, because the taverns were the talk show radios of their time. That's where you went to discuss politics. There was a surprising amount of literacy in the early 19th century in America, but where you went to discuss ideas was in the pub, in the tavern. So he was listening to all this stuff growing up. And
he was the LBC listener of his day.
Absolutely. He was that annoying caller. Yeah. And
it's Martin from Kinderhook. What would you like to say, Martin? Well, Ian.
So through that, he kind of learns how to kind of like twist arms, how to persuade political insiders. He takes that into state politics in New York, and then in this weird period of American history where there are no real relative left and relative right, there's only one political party, he realizes that actually what's needed is discipline, because otherwise you have chaos when it comes to elections, because it's sectional as opposed to political.
McDonald's have always done their little bit for young people.
Like when they offered us apprenticeships and paid for our degrees.
And now they're starting to put youth workers in their UK restaurants and communities.
To mentor us and give career advice.
And it's not just one or two youth workers either.
It'll be a whole team of us working across 1,300 restaurants.
Add to that all the training McDonald's offer to over 92,000 young crew members. And well, that little bit doesn't feel so little anymore. McDonald's, change a little, change a lot.
So he ran for state senate in 1812 and won. And he ran a campaign, as you say, opposing the Bank of the United States, which was another bit. That was another fissure in American politics, really the first half of the 19th century.
This is going to really come to bite him in the bum by the time he actually becomes president. That there's this fundamental divide, as you said, between how people see this brand new country. It's an experiment. And the fact that there is this central government, many politicians see that as actually anti the very ethos of the state, that to have control over fiscal matters. And he's really against that. And it's going to be disastrous by the mid-1830s.
And let's talk about the politics of New York at that time, because again, that's something that really guided his own political career over this period. He had an interesting feud, I suppose you could call it, with DeWitt Clinton. Was it DeWitt Clinton? When I was reading the audiobook, I wasn't sure about that.
And that's really what makes him a star, because he is somebody who's he's able to marshal other people around him. DeWitt Clinton is much more powerful than him, but he's able to get this coalition to form the Bushtails, and the fight between them lasts for like 4 years, but it then puts him on the national national stage.
And he was still very young at this stage.
He's very young, and he can basically then go straight into the Senate. You know, he's seen as the consummate political operator. He understands many of the rules of politics as we'd kind of understand them today, and he builds this coalition. He has his supporters put in key places of the administration. You know, he's a political operator as we'd understand it today.
And how did his career develop once he entered the US Senate?
He moves very quickly through the Senate. He realizes that there's an election in 1824. And that election literally is a dead heat between Quincy Adams and between Jackson. And remember, this is a period where there are no political parties, only one, the Democratic Republicans. And he can see that this is destabilizing for party discipline, that you don't have very clear messages, and all the four various candidates, they're all kind of regional. The one which has the widest kind of geographic spread is actually Jackson, who's the populist. He is the kind of fissure between the founder class and the new self-made man. He's this wild-haired orator who pulls himself up by his bootstraps in the middle of nowhere America, becomes a millionaire, and is also a successful general. That's what gives him a platform in the 1812-1814 war, where unfortunately he beat us Brits in the Battle of New Orleans. That's where he really gets his name. And he's utterly a man of the people. Cutting a long story short, in terms of the Electoral College, he doesn't have enough votes. Initially, Van Buren doesn't support him, but then swings behind him and organises for him. What happens?
What caused him to change his mind?
Because he sees that he has the widest kind of geographical spread of support, not only in his home state of Tennessee, but in other bits of the United States, where the other candidates are much more regional. So he kind of swings behind him, organises for him, fundraises for him. However, because no candidate gets a majority in the Electoral College, then goes to Congress for them to decide who's going to be the president. Congress has this corrupt bargain, and they give it to Quincy Adams. And there's a big, massive factional falling out between the Democratic Republicans, but they're all the same party. Martin Van Buren is then going to sit down, and with actually a guy called Calhoun, kind of work out how they can take the lessons which he's learnt in New York politics, state politics, into national politics. So by the time the next election in 1828, there is party discipline. There is, and he understands that there should be a party convention. There needs to be some way of the common man, but also the party machinery, anointing a presidential candidate. So really, what gets birthed out of that corrupt bargain in the next 4 years is the modern American political system.
Do you think that's his main legacy?
Absolutely. And literally almost 200 years later, it's still there in place, at least in the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party, the Democratic Republicans of then, is not the Democratic Party of now, even though there's a straight line between the two. The Republicans don't have a party machine anymore. The Democrats still do, by the skin of their teeth. You know, Joe Biden was the establishment candidate, and he's now the president. Donald Trump wasn't for the Republicans in the last election. You know, so he builds up, he understands that to have a clear set of principles, you have to have at least one coalition between one factional interest and another, and then you enforce party discipline. So the messaging is really tight. You have a convention that then nominates somebody which knocks out all the others. So it's a very clear choice. And he actually kind of sees it as a way of actually uniting America, conversely, by having two political parties and not one.
you quote from a letter that Van Buren wrote to Thomas Ritchie in your essay, which is all around this subject. You call it one of the most far-sighted documents in American political history.
Because he understands that to get politics done, it cannot be based around personality and sectional interests. There's an incident called the nullification crisis, which happens in 1836 in South Carolina. South Carolina almost secedes from the United States. The United States, some 50 years after it was formed, was still kind of touch and go whether it would actually last as a unified nation. And kind of one of the things, how people kind of addressed the United States back then was to call it these United States. Up until the point of the Civil War, many Americans, or most Americans, saw themselves as belonging to their state first and then America second. So having these regional presidential candidates, he saw as actually being a way of weakening the new republic. Remember, it's still new back then. You know, many of the politicians who are in power, though they're kind of fading, could remember the War of Independence, the Revolutionary War, the British, the Redcoats. They could just about still remember. It was still within living memory. And having, let's say, a senator who's pushing the sectional interests of, let's say, the South or somebody from the Midwest is potentially going to be the end of the country. So he very clearly said, we need Southern planters, you know, holders of slaves with Northern Republicans. We need to be a party. It's going to be one coalition, and we have policies which they can both just about get behind, and we help to unite the country, and there's a national message.
So, during the presidency of Andrew Jackson, what happened to Martin Van Buren?
Over here.
It's quite interesting, this bit of his story, I think.
Yeah, you know, one of the things which he does, he actually comes to Britain. You know, he's the Foreign Secretary, or the Secretary of State, sorry. As the Americans would call it, we'd call it the Foreign Secretary. And this is the age just before the telegraph. So one of the things which he had to do was get on a boat. It's a bit like Jefferson, who was the first Secretary of State, had to, you know, he got on a boat and went to France. Oh, sorry, he's the ambassador to France, actually. Oh, anyway, you can leave that bit in. But he had to get on a boat and he came to Britain. And one of the things which he did was to, there's a land dispute between us Brits and them Yanks in Maine, so the northeastern state, and he kind of like sorts that out, and he cuts a real kind of dash and a figure, because he was always incredibly courteous, but also and
he dressed well.
And that's where I was coming to. He's always called a bit of a dandy. Mm. And this is it's kind of an interesting time where the old kind of effect way of dressing from the late 19th century radically gets upturned by the French Revolution, and a little bit by the American Revolution, but the French Revolution. But before we get to that kind of really somber Victorian way of dressing, where everybody just wore incredibly dark clothes or just black, you know, he still is a little splash of colour. And he always wore these kind of green suits with yellow shirts and crushed velvet. And
they're like yourself.
I look like a Victorian gentleman today. And it's one of the things which you don't ever read when you read about Van Buren, that he was somebody who... he wasn't like an Arabist. He wasn't, but there was a certain element of him, I think, thinking that he's moving in circles which maybe he shouldn't have been, or that, you know, he feels and one of the ways in which he could make himself feel like he should be in the presence of, let's say, people with more money or have a landed family name, was to dress really well. That's something which everybody always said about him.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So in terms of the Andrew Jackson years, he was a close ally of Jackson, but sort of he held various different positions in that period. How did those various jobs that he had lead up to him becoming a candidate for president?
Well, he becomes, so it's called the Kitchen Cabinet. And Jackson basically comes to power, and it can't be underestimated as to how much of a revolutionary change Jackson was. As I said, he's a self-made man. He's not one of these kind of founders or a son of a founder. He hasn't written the Declaration of Independence. In many ways, Andrew Jackson is the personification of the American dream. Born in the middle of nowhere, is an orphan at an early age, becomes a millionaire, fights for his country against those damn Brits, etc., etc., and then becomes the president. When he comes to power, the people who gathers around him are his mates, basically, with the kind of exception, really, of Van Buren. Van Buren is seen as the most able out of this kitchen cabinet. You know, he can get things done. He understands how Washington works. He understands politics in a way that other people just don't. And he's this shining star, and he becomes a real confidant of Jackson. So Jackson is the mouthpiece, he's the populist. Jackson is the Trump of his day, wild haired and whatever. He has this real, very manicured kind of image. But his fixer is our man, Martin Van Buren, who actually gets things done.
And you brought him in as vice president in his second term?
Because he is the foreign secretary. And the Senate under Calhoun basically don't ratify him for another term. This really upsets Jackson, and Jackson says, right, I'm going for you, Calhoun. He gets rid of Calhoun and then makes him his vice president when he runs again in 1832.
And was that really essentially the way that it was the way he became president in the end, wasn't it? If he hadn't been vice president, maybe he wouldn't have succeeded.
Yeah, but also remember, by this time, by 1828, we have the start of the Democratic Party as we kind of understand it. So he's building a machinery around him, a political machine around him, and there's a certain level of patronage, and he's got friends and allies. So one of the interesting things about Van Buren is he's going to lose the election in 1840. He's going to run again in 1844. He's actually even going to go again in 1848 for another party. And I don't think it's by accident that he can keep on running. He's got a lot of friends in high places, and he's the consummate political insider.
Tell us about the crisis with South Carolina, because he played a key role in that.
One of the things which differentiates the South from the middle and the west and the north of the states is its attitude around tariffs, not just slavery. We think slavery, but it's also tariffs. And as I mentioned before, the idea of states being more important, and let's call it states' rights, is something which is much more important then than it is now. So one of the things which this new coalition of the Democratic Party is always kind of struggling with is the fact that Northern Democrats are kind of pro-tariffs, you know, putting a barrier around a state's industries to kind of protect their indigenous industries against, you know, imports kind of coming in. The Southerners aren't kind of up for this at all. And South Carolina almost secedes from the United States because of this. It's called the nullification crisis because they want to get rid of a set of tariffs. And it's Van Buren who's this moderating voice in the government to say, look, we need to tread carefully here. He understands potentially that you could unravel the United States. And it's one of those things which, in the run-up to the Civil War, the nullification crisis is a bit of a precursor. It's that kind of like comet which happens, you know, some 20-odd years beforehand. But it shows you that there is this resentment in the South about too much government, about telling them what to do. And South Carolina, you know, there were many people that wanted South Carolina to leave the United States. And it's Van Buren who helps to calm things down, to have backroom deals, and to make sure that the experiment still continues.
So the convention took place in 1835. Van Buren was chosen. How did the election go? What kind of campaign was it?
It was, Ian, I don't know an awful lot about that election. You know, when you study kind of old Kinderhook, it's really the next one, which is the one where he's seen as being kind of leaden-footed. This is really a coronation. There is another political party, but there isn't. There is one solidified force. He's going up against numerous candidates. He's backed by Jackson. That's the big thing. Andrew Jackson is incredibly popular. His tenure has been seen as a success then, but immediately it's going to be ridden with controversy as soon as Martin Van Buren becomes president. But this is like a coronation. You have one set of political operatives who know what they're doing because they have a party machine, they're disciplined, and you have three other candidates, and they're all over the place. But that's going to change by the time of the next election.
So in terms of when he becomes president, what were the challenges facing him? What were the challenges facing America after this period of Andrew Jackson as president?
Through the second part of the presidency of Jackson, there is the winding up of the Second National Bank. And we know much more about economics than they ever did back then. They didn't understand that a national bank is needed to be able, at least, even if you think it shouldn't be that powerful, but in terms of when there is a crisis, to be able to move money around the economy, to shore it up. That knowledge just wasn't there. This was a stated principle that we don't need large institutions, let alone financial ones, over the economy. So it's wound up, and the day he becomes president, there's a massive crash in the economy, and brokerage houses just go bust. People lose their farms, and there isn't an instrument to be able to put money in the hands of whether it's small American institutions or into the pockets of Americans to keep the economy going. That would have been the National Bank, which had just been wound up. So it's literally as soon as he starts, it's not his fault, but he is very much the heir of the policies of Jackson. America goes through its deepest recession since the creation of the United States.
And he came under a lot of criticism in that early period. I think you say in the essay he was nicknamed Van Ruin. And you say whatever could go wrong in the next 4 years did.
He's really seen now as having no new ideas, but then also not even the charisma to project it to the public. Jackson was definitely a man of the people. Van Buren is a political insider who's somewhat dogmatic. And what you hear is that what a lot of people say about him is that when he was the president, he was still actually a Democratic Party operative. You know, he didn't really speak to the nation. He didn't go out and create new coalitions. He was very dogmatic. And one of the ways in which he shows his dogma is not only being able to have no solutions to this massive economic crash, but in the Trail of Tears, all of the policies of the Jackson government, and one of them was the resettlement of the First Nations peoples. So in the early 19th century, you still have a lot of Native Americans, First Nations people, who live in the eastern states. And as part of, there's no other way of saying it, white supremacy, the American government says we need to push them to the side of the Mississippi. And the
and that was under Andrew Jackson.
That was under Andrew Jackson, and he starts it, and it's 1830, I believe, is the that Indian Act. But it's called the Trail of Tears because he continues it ruthlessly and does not apologize for it at all by the end of the 1830s. So, like, the Cherokee Indians are moved from the southeast, and there are various kind of supposed inducements given to them. You know, if you can become citizens if you stay here. But these weren't the Plains Indians of popular kind of imagination. These were native peoples who lived in towns, who had schools, had churches. A lot of them were, you know, were Christian by then. But they're ruthlessly told you need to up sticks because they wanted their land. And a quarter of these people died, you know, being marched by the American military over the other side of the Mississippi to lands which were unproductive. And he, you know, executes and prosecutes that policy.
Was there anything in his 4 years as president that he could legitimately be proud of?
He was even against Texas joining the Union. So, like, he's on the wrong side of so many things whilst he's president. So I'm sure that there must be something. But off the top of my head, I can't think of one. And in terms of the history books, he goes down a trail of tears, not being able to do anything with this massive recession.
So he lost in 1840 when he tried to be re-elected to the Whig, William Henry Harrison. And yet his party wanted him to stand again 4 years later.
Yes, which I think goes to what I was saying before, is that he is a massive political insider. He knows how to get deals done. He knows people within the party machinery. The kind of, it's kind of called Tammany Hall, which doesn't really exist anymore. But that the fact that every American city up until the 1960s, 70s had this party machine, whether it be one guy, always a guy, who would know where, you know, where everyone was buried, knew how, which arms to twist to get certain policies through, who you needed to promote. He knew that statewide, you know, the countrywide. So because of that, even though he's run this disastrous presidency and his party's actually lost power, He still runs 4 years later, and even for the Free Soil Party, 4 years later.
So you've already made clear you think he belongs in the bottom bit of the presidential rankings. Interestingly, when C-SPAN did their latest rankings, he came in the mid-30s.
I wouldn't say he's bottom rung, because he...
But above Hoover, above Harding...
Well, Hoover, in popular imagination, is a total disaster, because for the simple reason that we actually have celluloid film of him. You know, that's really quite important as to how we, our opinions are of presidents. You know, you can see him move. And the other shocking thing, I was just having this conversation with somebody this morning. So Hoover loses the presidency in 1932. And then you have FDR, and it's a complete revolutionary change in terms of the politics of America, let alone you're going to have the Second World War, the Korean War, and you're going to have, you know, civil rights by the 1960s. Hoover actually turns up at the Republican political convention in 1960 when Nixon is going to run against Kennedy. When I was doing my research for the podcast and I was watching this on YouTube, I was like, it feels like he feels like a character from another age completely, because it's pre-television and stuff. But anyway, Hoover, wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time. The politics of America economically was set fast by the time he was going to be president, you know. And then you have this laissez-faire political attitude that you shouldn't intervene too much with the economy, but the economy is going to crash anyway. Pre-Hoover, just that he just happened to be the man when the economy crashed. But we're talking about Van Buren, sorry.
Well, we were.
Martin Van Buren sits at a unique inflection point of American history, shaping the modern American political system like no other historical figure. He pointed to an alternative future and authored a narrative for an America that could have been but never was. Born in Kinderhook, New York, to a Dutch-American family, the young Martin grew up speaking his mother tongue, as was customary among town inhabitants. Though the history of the first white people to successfully colonize New York made an indelible mark on the American landscape, it was in Van Buren's ascendance to the office of presidency that we were given glimpses of an altogether different America, one where English was not the official language of the new nation, and where the United States was anything but united. Van Buren was the first president to have been born after the American Revolution. Being one of America's many 19th century mutton-chopped forgotten presidents, his lasting legacy of the creation of modern American political duopoly and the notion of national politics has remained largely unremembered. His legacy doesn't stop there, however. He also helped usher in the post-founder phase of the American presidency and was a key architect of the modern Democratic Party. It certainly is peculiar that a president whose contributions are so deeply woven into the fabric of American society should be so buried and forgotten. Kinderhook was a small town south of Albany, New York, where Dutch was exclusively spoken during the 18th century, despite the resident status as fifth-generation Americans of Dutch ancestry. Van Buren's father, Abraham, had fought in the Revolutionary War and served as a captain in the Albany County Militia's 7th Regiment. He was a man steeped in the politics and mission of the new republic. Abraham, a Jeffersonian Republican, served as the town clerk and was a proprietor of a local tavern. At the times, taverns were very much at the centre of local politicking, with men entering the establishments to discuss the news of the day as much as they came to imbibe. It was in this environment that the young Martin was first educated in politics and began to understand what was required to acquire political power and wield influence. It was not until he was 7 years old that Van Buren began speaking English. He attended a one-room schoolhouse in Kinderhook until the age of 14, marking the end of his formal education, as he did not go on to attend college. As a town clerk, Martin's father had extensive local contacts and was able to find his son a clerk position at a lawyer's office, where he would remain for 7 years, running errands by day and studying the law by night. The hard work paid off. In 1803, at the age of 21, Martin gained admission to the New York State Bar. After a year in New York, Van Buren returned to Kinderhook to open up a law practice. It was during this time that flickers of his future politics could begin to be seen. The law practice was successful in boosting his reputation locally, where he championed the common people rather than the landed elite in property cases. His future populist politics of the late 1820s were clearly visible, alongside a desire for limited federal government and defence of individual liberties. In the early years of the 19th century, America's two political parties were the Democratic Republicans and the Federalists, each doggedly fighting to navigate the direction of the Republic's future. New York State was very much at the centre of the competing political factions. Van Buren, believing in small national government, aligned himself with the Democratic Republicans and was rewarded with a county official's post in 1808. At the time, his political allegiance was at best fluid, leaving his detractors to call him unprincipled as he shifted alliances while accruing local political power. With a reputation bolstered by a slew of courtroom victories, Van Buren ran for New York State Senate in 1812, beating the Federalist opponent. He ran a campaign opposing the Bank of the United States while supporting the impending war with Great Britain. This was his first electoral success and the beginning of an earnest paving of the road towards the White House. The War of 1812 against the British started badly for the Americans, resulting in vicious infighting among Democratic Republicans and the pushing of personal rivalries to the fore. Wanting party discipline, Van Buren formed his own faction within the party, known as the Bucktails, and committed himself to the defeat of the local Federalists. The Bucktails also railed against New York's most powerful politician and fellow Democrat Republican, DeWitt Clinton, whom they believed was not strident enough in his defence of limited federal government. Such was the enmity between Van Buren and Clinton that their rivalry became the centrepiece of New York state politics during the 1810s. By the end of the decade, Van Buren, now 32, was appointed the state of New York's Attorney General. With the role as New York's leading Democrat-Republican now fully formed, his total control of the party during this time came to be known by his detractors as the Albany Regency. Politically powerful in New York State, Van Buren won election in the United States Senate in 1821. Upon arrival in Washington, D.C., he cultivated an air of sophistication and adopted the dress of a dandy to accompany his ready wit and unfailing tact. His warnings in the corridors of power about the lack of party discipline marked him out as an up-and-coming political force. With the end of the James Monroe administration in 1825 and the Federalists vanquished around the nation, politically the Democratic Republicans stood supreme across America. But the price they were to pay for this victory was the erosion of political party unity. This period saw key Federalist economic programs and institutions adopted by the Democratic Republicans. National tariffs came in 1816, and a second Bank of the United States was incorporated. These policies were anathema to many Democratic Republicans. Elements of the party, including Van Buren, found the developments worrisome. Van Buren also warned that such policies weakened the primacy of Southern slaveholding interests, enfeebling the National Party's political foundation. The creation of cabals was the most unintended consequence of wide single-party identification, rather than fostering a political harmony among Democratic Republicans. On the eve of the 1824 election, there were at least three distinct factions in the party: the Adams-Clay Republicans, the Jacksonians, and the Old Republicans, with each promoting their own candidate. In addition to factional candidates, the party was increasingly riven by regional concerns, with separate parts of the country backing different candidates for commander-in-chief. This made a true national consensus around a candidate almost impossible. In the election, Van Buren threw his support behind Secretary of the Treasury William Crawford of Georgia, a man of impeccable Jeffersonian credentials. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams dominated the vote in New England and won some support elsewhere. Clay dominated in his home state of Kentucky and won majorities in two neighboring states. Crawford won the Virginia vote and did well in neighboring North Carolina. General Andrew Jackson won in Tennessee, his home state, and in Pennsylvania. Of all the candidates, Jackson had the broadest geographical support. The two candidates with the most votes in the election, Jackson and Adams, both fell short of the Electoral College votes needed to claim the presidency. The rules of the Constitution mandated that the presidency be decided in the House of Representatives, where the fourth-placed finisher, Senator Henry Clay, threw his votes to Adams, who was then crowned victor.
The supporters of Jackson were outraged, believing a corrupt bargain had been hatched between Adams and Clay, which had cost their man the White House. They, along with Van Buren, vowed to win back the White House in 1828. Van Buren believed that Adams was a secret Federalist, pointing to the new president's intention to strengthen the federal government's role in economic development as a prime example. He brought together the factions of the Democratic Republicans hostile to Adams under Jackson's standard. The Jackson-Van Buren coalition was formed, with the populist Jackson promising a return to smaller federal government and a protection of state rights. In 1827, in the run-up to the 1828 election, Van Buren wrote to Virginia newspaper editor Thomas Ritchie, a Jeffersonian political leader in the state. Van Buren argued that the time had come for South Carolinian John C. Calhoun's idea of a national nominating convention to choose a presidential candidate before the 1828 election. The idea of a convention would be a key milestone towards the formation of a new political party and would put an end to the political regionalism that had marked the 1824 election. Van Buren thought a party convention would help focus the opposition to the incumbent president and solidify politics around principles rather than personal coteries and local interests. Lastly, he opined that the divide between the northern and southern states could be healed by creating a national political coalition, something that a convention would aim to create. Though a supporter of Jackson, Van Buren thought that a congressional caucus or general convention would help rein him in, were he to become president. Van Buren worried that Jackson's personal popularity meant that he might govern with little thought of the Democratic-Republican Party, or party policy in general, so a convention would be a prudent way to keep him on message. In the letter to Thomas Ritchie, Buren stated this, "I have long been satisfied that we can only get rid of the present and restore a better state of things by combining General Jackson's personal popularity with the portion of old party feeling yet remaining. The sentiment is spreading and would of itself be sufficient to nominate him at the convention. The call of such a convention, its exclusive Republican character, and the refusal of Mr. Adams and his friends to become party to it, would draw new the old party lines, and the subsequent contest would re-establish them. State nomination alone would fall far short of that object." Van Buren's letter to Ritchie was one of the most far-sighted documents in American political history. It set in place an American political system that still stands today. Forming a national party system was needed to stop the fictionalization of American politics. Van Buren united the planters of the South and the Republicans of the North around a united political identity. Van Buren saw the 1828 election as an opportunity to restore the party to its first principles of limited federal government. If General Jackson will put his election on old party grounds, preserve the old systems, avoid, if not condemn, the practices of the last campaign, he said, we can, by adding his personal popularity to the yet remaining force of old party feeling, not only succeed in electing him, but our success, when achieved, will be worth something. By the start of 1828, Van Buren had created his campaign to put Jackson in the White House. It was customary at the time for actual candidates not to go on the stump, leaving Van Buren in the position of chief fundraiser, strategist, and political mouthpiece for Jackson. With some states expanding their franchise, there were new voters to win. With his large parades, rallies, and fiery speeches, Van Buren targeted first-time voters, who he saw as vital to obtain the presidency. Van Buren's most difficult challenge during the campaign was persuading the candidate to suffer in dignified silence as the Adams camp levelled virulent attacks on Jackson's wife's character. His wife was called an adulteress and a bigamist, much to Jackson's distress and anger. While keeping Jackson's temper in check was one problem, another was the protectionism growing strong in the West and Northeast. Van Buren had to be mindful of the Southern planters' more free trade leanings if his candidate was to triumph in the election. Courting both camps, he kept his coalition together through the 1828 tariff, known in the South as the Tariff of Abominations. This kept Westerners on his side, where they might have voted for the sitting president while kicking the issue down the road for Southerners. During the campaign, Van Buren was elected governor of his home state of New York, a position he had sought in order to improve Jackson's chances of winning the state in the election and securing its Electoral College votes. The 1828 United States presidential election was held from the 31st of October to the 2nd of December. Jackson's victory over Adams is widely heralded as a triumph of the common man. Significantly, it also started a newly reformed Democratic-Republican Party that gave birth to the modern Democratic Party. With nearly all white men eligible to vote, 9.5% of the nation cast a vote, compared with only 3.4% in 1824. Jackson won the Electoral College vote 178 to 83. With 20 electoral votes for Jackson secured in New York State, Van Buren resigned from the governorship and joined the Jackson administration as Secretary of State. In Jackson's cabinet, Van Buren shone as the most capable member among a sea of men who were personal friends of Jackson. During his tenure as Secretary of State, he became one of the president's most trusted confidants and an advisor who Jackson knew he could trust, in contrast to hangers-on who were dubbed the Kitchen Cabinet. Jackson came to office to entrench white interests, and key to this goal was the Indian Removal Act of 1830. This act gave the president power to negotiate removal treaties with Indian tribes living east of the Mississippi. The Indians were to give up their ancient land, leaving their schools and community for the promise of land to the west. The prize of citizenship was offered to those who wanted to stay. The act was to lead to the Trail of Tears, an act of calculated genocide and a grave stain on the young republic. However, it was President Van Buren who most brutally enforced Jackson's Indian Removal Act, not the populist president. In his new role as ambassador to the United Kingdom, Van Buren sailed for England in 1832. Always well-mannered, he was popular in London's diplomatic circles, the ending of the border dispute in Maine with Britain being one of his accomplishments while abroad. In late February 1832, the Senate rejected Van Buren's nomination to continue as UK ambassador, with Vice President John C. Calhoun casting the deciding vote. This angered Jackson, but after reflection, Calhoun's act gave him ample reason to remove him from the ticket in the coming presidential election. Jackson decided that his advisor, Van Buren, was to be his next vice president, saying that the people in mass would take you up and elect you vice president. After returning to the US political fray in July 1832, Jackson needed Van Buren's help in drafting the president's message to Congress explaining his proposed veto to the recharter of the Second Bank of the United States. Getting rid of the bank was an article of faith to both Jackson and Van Buren. The lack of a national bank was to have grave consequences for the country later in the decade, and Van Buren's impotence during the forthcoming Depression was to be one of the many blemishes on his presidency.
Hello, Royfield here, season's greetings, and you all have my abject apologies that I've managed to put out barely a podcast this year in 2021. I have started working extensively this year. Not only do I now teach at the University of California, Berkeley, I teach the business of podcasting, but I've also now have got the gig of being executive producer for OSET, doing a collection of podcasts around American democracy, and this has meant that I've been incredibly busy. However, there is no excuse. This year, I should have been able to at least get out three or four podcasts. So a little bit of an excuse, a little bit of a reason as to why things have been so threadbare on 10 American presidents. And to that note, I have to say hi to Ken Rowe and to David Gould, who posted a message just yesterday on the 10 American Presidents Facebook group. G'day, Royfield. I've been listening to your
listened to you since the first episode and going through the first couple of podcasts again, are you planning to do any more episodes on the actual presidents? Yes, I am. Bear with me, it will actually happen. We are halfway through Reagan, but I did say that about 10 months ago. Anyway, Ken, bear with me, it will happen. If you want to catch up with some of the other things that I do, I also do a podcast called Mid-Atlantic, which looks at contemporary US and UK politics compared and contrasted. And I do a little show called Map Corner, which looks at maps and mapping, and is much more fun than it sounds. And lastly, also do a podcast called Intelligent Speech, where I just interview interesting people about random topics. So if you want more Royfield Brown content, Map Corner, Mid-Atlantic and Intelligent Speech are good places to go.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.